This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Welcome to Community or Chaos. This morning, I'm introducing the author of Slowing the Sun, Nadine Hooda. Welcome to Community of Chaos, Nadine.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you, well, first, if you're listening to this, you can podcast this later as well by going to oar.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to Community of Chaos. And if you wish, you can also, at the same site, choose to your favorite podcast or program for the FM Awards night. Nadine, tell us about your book, Slowing the Sun, and why you wrote it.
Kia ora. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's So, Slowing the Sun. Slowing the Sun is it's a collection of essays, and on the back of the book, or how you might describe the book, or how I might describe it in a sort of like elevator pitch, is that it's a book that explores the relational impacts of climate change. And by relational, I just mean human-centered, labor-focused, as a sort of counterpoint to the normal impacts that are assumed when we talk about climate change, which tend to focus on the physical environment only, often centering things like carbon emissions and, you know, just the excesses that have led to the environmental degradation that we are living with. But actually, I had a conversation actually with a publisher, and this is Tom from BWB, and he said, it is a climate book, but he said, actually, I think it's a love story too. And you know, it is. I didn't actually set out to write a book about climate change. I started writing, I was writing about climate change from about 5 years ago, and I was publishing on the spinoff. It wasn't my intention that they should become a book. Initially, all I wanted to do, I think, very literally, was slow things down and try and understand. I didn't understand the language of climate change. I felt overwhelmed. I felt panicked about all that I didn't understand. I felt stupid a lot of the time. And so initially, it was sort of like a private challenge to try and understand climate change. And then my brother passed away. He died. He died by suicide in 2020 during the second COVID lockdown, and the title "Slowing the Sun" references the morning that I woke up, and I saw the sun coming up. And my mum was not in Aotearoa, New Zealand, at the time. She was on the United States, so she was behind us in time, and I had this feeling, almost like a magical sort of feeling, that I could, like Maui, slow the sun, and I could stop the sun from rising in the United States, because then I knew that I'd have to call my mum. And so Slowing the Sun is about, I think it speaks to what we all know to be true, and which is that the harm that we are witnessing in the environment also mimics the spiritual disconnection that we experience in our personal lives, in our family relationships, within our communities.
Yes, I often have a feeling that a lot of us feel homeless, not just in the sense of not having a home, which is also, but homeless in our societies, especially Western societies, disconnected.
It is disconnect. And that disconnection, this is what I discovered from the research that I did for the book and for the people that I spoke to, is that disconnection is not an accident. It's a known and deliberate outcome of systems and structures that aid the accumulation of profit. There is a distinct profit. There is an economic profit to be gained from disconnection. And so so on the flip side, even though, and by that I am referring to colonialism, which actively sought to separate people from land and to make land productive and to make to profit from excesses and to concentrate profits in a small group of people. And so by the same token, though, I realized that anything that we do to restore that connection to land, and it can be as simple as taking off your shoes and sinking your feet into the literal whenua ground, and whenua in te reo Māori means placenta as well as land. That is the land and the source that sustains us. That can be healing. So it can feel really overwhelming if we focus on the structures that are continuing to actively profit from the disconnections that we experience from land and from each other. But also conversely, we do have more power than we might realize.
One of the things I realize is that people still, especially I think in New Zealand, care for each other.
Yeah.
And in some neighborhood, part of the reason I'm an old man now, and part of the reason I can live happily on my cul-de-sac is my neighbors, who are mostly younger than I am.
Beautiful.
And, yeah.
I also have an amazing relationship with my neighbors, and I'm at the moment having to think about moving house because where I am, it's a two-story house. My mum lives with me, and she had a stroke 9 years ago, and so she, you know, is living with disability, and it's really worrying for me. But the big reason I don't want to leave my home is not so much for the home. I do love the house, but really, when I look out the window and I live in a cul-de-sac and I know the names of all of my neighbors and we know each other so well, and I'm so attached. I'm attached to them, and I'm attached to the tree in my front lawn, which is, you know, the tree belongs to the land and the land is outside, and I can always drive past the tree, you know. But it is a beautiful thing to live in community.
It's a funny thing about land. I used to, when I first came here, we had really great state houses. In fact, I bought a state house, which I shouldn't have been able to buy because they shouldn't have been for sale. Mm. Well, that's my prejudice.
Yes.
But I did. Mm. But you can't, I really wonder if you can really ever own a piece of land. You can borrow it, but can you own it and do what you wish with it?
I mean, that's such a great question, or a great thing to sit with. And I think it comes back to the language, because the land belongs to itself. I don't believe that I don't believe in ownership in the sense of deeds of title and these things. However, they are very real, and they sure. do, these structures do have very real consequences and constraints and controls on our lives. Yeah. So I'm not denying that.
You can't ignore it, that's for sure.
We can't ignore it. We do live under these this regime, I guess, a regime of thought. But in truth, the land belongs to itself, and we belong to the land. And it's not ownership. And what I'm basing that on is te reo Māori. And I'm not a fluent speaker of te reo Māori. I'm a forever learner. And I am a lover of language. I should have probably studied linguistics. I speak Spanish and is much more fluently than I speak te reo Māori. But I'm fascinated by languages. And I'm fascinated by all that is hidden within the English language, or perhaps that we've forgotten because we don't study Latin or we don't know the origins of our words in quite the same way. But with te reo Māori, the whakapapa, the etymology of the words, is very present in the language. And so the language for words for ownership, they're not directly translatable, and we know that because we just need to look at the history of titiriti or waitangi and the constant negotiations and arguments about how to define different terms. But when I think about, there's a word, a preposition, it's nōku, and it is really an expression and a statement or a way of expressing your attachment to land or to a place, and you're really saying, I belong to that place. And when you belong to that place, you have a responsibility to it. And that's a very, very different thing to this idea of ownership and the rights that come with ownership. That's not present in te reo Māori in quite the same way as it is within the English language that dominates the way that we think.
Do you want to talk about your childhood and growing up?
Sure.
That's up to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know.
But I think I really got into the book when I was reading about your mom and your dad. Mm-hmm. And I thought of my parents who grew up during the Depression.
Mm. Yeah, I'd love to hear about that. I'd love to hear about your parents too. And that is the correct starting place, when we meet to exchange stories of our pepeha, the places that have raised us and sustained us, and people who have raised us. So I was raised by my mum in Tāmaki Makaurau ki Te Tonga, that's Papakura. She separated from my dad when I was about two, and my dad, his people are from the far north. He's from Waiomio, and his mum was from Tauranga, and he moved away from Kawakawa and came to Papakura in the 60s and met my mum. And my mum arrived from England, from Wallasey. So my mum was like she was actually a 10-pound pon. My grandparents came out after the war in 1948, I think. Isn't that terrible? It just goes through my mind. But so my mum and my dad met as teenagers. I want to say at a dance, and they had three children. I've got two older brothers. We grew up in South Auckland, and my mum separated from him. And for her reasons, which makes sense to me now, but didn't so much when I was younger, she didn't let me go and stay with him, but my brothers did. And I knew, you know, I always knew that I was Māori growing up, but I grew up in a period during the 80s when it wasn't something to be proud of for me. And also,
wasn't that when the change was just beginning to be changed? comes.
Yeah, I mean, I look back now at the history of what was happening in Aotearoa then, and you know, the revitalization, the reclamation movement that was well underway through Ngāti Matua, through Whenukupa and the land march in 1975, and I feel like it was right there at the edge of the periphery of my childhood, but they were, I think that they were marching for tamariki, for children like myself who were growing up under this oppressive shame, for you know, things that we, you know, were lumped upon us, stereotypes that were not true and not real. Now, when I think about the stereotypes that I grew up with, and I think, well, any wonder I thought that it was a shameful thing to be Māori, but the stereotypes were wrong and not true. But as a child, you don't necessarily, you just often take on board, you know, those social attitudes. And it is really upsetting now to look back and think, you know, like I grew up thinking, you know, like trying to hold my lips, and I've, the audience can't, the listeners can't see, I have an appearance that I think is, and definitely when I was little, you know, I looked Māori, but I used to try and hold my lips in for school photos because I thought that it was a bad thing to have big lips, you know. That's
yeah, but social stereotypes can be hard.
Yeah.
I remember my grandmother and my mother's story about my mother was part of her childhood was in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came to California toward the end of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. And she had to take speech lessons to get rid of her accent.
Really?
Really.
When did your, so tell me a bit about your family.
Well, my grandfather was a miner and a construction worker most of his life.
A miner in
construction. Everything from gold to copper to coal. In fact, he was at Ludlow, Colorado during the massacre.
The massacre?
Yeah, they went on strike.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they lived in, the houses were owned by the company.
Wow.
And so they had to put up a tent. He was single at that point. I think it was about 1914. And they surrounded the tent village, and the miners went to the railhead to stop the scabs.
And the scabs?
Strike breakers.
Oh, that's what they had that name.
Yeah. And
oh wow!
And they fired artillery and machine guns into that tent city, and then they torched this tents, and 15 women and children were killed there.
No, oh my God!
And about between 60 and 80 people were killed in the strike.
60 and 80.
Between
60 and 80 people.
Yeah, America had a much more violent rate.
Yeah.
Labor history than New Zealand.
Wow. And I mean, today, tomorrow, when is it? Thursday, we have this mega strike here.
Yeah.
You know, it is, there is always risk.
Yeah.
But the power that we have as a collective.
Yeah, I never thought I'd get, you know, since I've been in New Zealand in particular, I never thought I'd get shot for any political action.
Mm.
But it can be different in different countries.
Yeah, absolutely. And so your parents immigrated?
No, I immigrated.
Ah.
1972, 73. Partly when Martin Luther King was assassinated, I thought it wasn't going to change that much. And I wanted a change.
And you chose also, to come to New Zealand? Did you know much about New Zealand?
Not much. I had a couple of friends were Quakers. And they were living here in the 70s. Norman Kirk was prime minister.
Mm.
And they described it as some kind of socialist paradise. I know it wasn't paradise, but I think it was better in some ways than it is now, to be honest with you. In some ways we've advanced, but in other ways, economically, we've gone backwards.
Oh, absolutely.
Anyway, that's my story. Well, there's more, but
there's more. So many stories, and I do think you. Yeah, I turned 48 yesterday, and so I feel more and more. I mean, it's not nostalgic, but more and more like it's so important to hear those stories of those who were there and who remember. Because so much is not conveyed in photographs or in archives. So it is important to breathe life into our own stories.
I should write about it, but I don't know if I will.
Yeah, well, there's still time.
Anyway, how did your mom bring you up as a single parent in the 80s?
You know, she worked. My mom was, my memories of my mom are of her always working. And not just that she was a factory out worker, so she was a sewing machinist. And for as long as I can remember, she would receive, or we would arrive home, I'd arrive home from school or wherever, and there were these, you know, four or five ginormous stacked boxes on the doorstep full of cut panels of fabric, which she would sew together. She sewed everything in her garage. She had an overlocker and a plane sewer, and they were industrial machines. They went, you know, just so fast, and they made such a loud noise. She always worked in the garage and later in the basement when we moved to a different house. And I could just, my childhood is punctuated by the sound of those machines. And often I couldn't see her face, but I could hear her. And so that image actually, and likewise the image of my father, because he was also a worker, and he worked on, he was a loader driver working on the roads, building the roads, working in quarries. Both of them have worked so hard in their lives. And I think what I realized by the time I finished writing this book is that they worked in a way that was invisible to the world, I guess, you know, and they and all of those who work in similar jobs, different industries, but in the same way, work and work and work, who work so hard, who work for very little no material reward, really, who work to survive, to pay the bills, to provide for their families, who don't receive the material benefits of their labor in terms of capital accumulation, and then who often get to the end of their lives. This is what I see with my parents now, and who sometimes feel as though, oh, you know, the reason I don't own a house, the reason, you know, I'm reliant on the pension and it's not enough to live on is because I haven't worked hard enough. And that enraged me. By the time I had finished writing the book and really just in these couple of essays about my parents' labor, I just wanted to pay homage to and recognize that they've worked so hard, and the fact that they, you know, both have precarious situations in their latter years is part of the design of the system, and that's so unjust. And then for now, the climate narrative to be all about insurance and managed retreat and all these issues, which are also important and also going to impact vulnerable people. But I feel like it's always lacking is the way in which those who had to build the colony and those who had to make the sacrifices at the level of family and household and body and physical body, because a lot of, you know, my parents are lucky to be alive and with some semblance of health. My dad's had cardiac arrest. My mum has had a stroke. Many ailments, but they're still here. I'm like, that's against the odds, because most people, when they labour that hard, they don't live into old age.
That's the thing that really infuriates me about when they talk about extending the retirement age. I mean, it's, you know, if you're an employer or a or a banker. It may be good for the economy because people die off before they collect a pension.
Mm, right.
It makes me angry. Sorry.
Me too.
I mean, people, you know, if you're a professor, say if I was getting paid for this,
mm-hmm.
I'd be happy to do it until I was, now I'm in my 80s.
Mm.
But if I was still lugging mail, unloading railway wagons, or working on a post office dock, I couldn't do that until I was 75 or whatever. You understand.
Mm.
And yet we talk about extending the retirement like it was just an economic decision. It didn't really affect people.
Mm. I mean, there's so much about the way in which these policies are constructed that that continue to invisibilize those who have given the most, especially, and it is a sacrifice, I think. And, you know, and that invisibility and the voicelessness, the ones who don't get to tell their stories, that was a primary motivation for me in writing the book or bringing the collection together. And perhaps it's maybe better to say, because as I said, I didn't really set out, I would have loved to have written a book, but I, again, because of the situation, it's not something that I had time to carve out to do. It was more that the essays came together in a particular way. But there are essays that are about purely, in a sense, almost autobiographical. They're about my parents. And the link to climate may seem to be tenuous. What does my mum, a Pākehā woman raising brown children in the 70s and 80s in racist New Zealand in the 70s and 80s, did I just say that? What does that have to do with climate? What does my dad, both of my parents are not, they didn't finish high school, they're not university educated. They would probably, before I wrote this book, really struggle to have a conversation about what climate change and politics means for them and their lives. Yet now, because of the book and because of the way, I've been able to show those links, the roads that my dad helped to build were made with the stones that came from the mountains that belonged to Mana Whenua, the Tupuna Mountain. Those were Tupuna, and they were quarried away, and they are still being quarried away. And when you say that your grandfather worked in a mine, often people do say, oh, it's such and such, and works in mines. But I'm always curious, like, what mines, and where did those materials go, and what did those materials build? And I think that's a key part of this climate story that is not presented enough, because it's not real enough for people. A lot of people have never set foot on a mine either. And it is often, very often it is men who go away and work in a mine, and we don't really know what they do. When I was writing this book, I was asking my dad all kinds of questions, and he just felt so, I think, like he had been a special person in his life, because I was interested in what he did. And he would ring me at odd times to tell me, oh, and then I did this job and that job, and he was telling me about it in detail. And just to extend this anecdote of the visibility and invisibility is that one of the jobs that he explained to me that he worked on was under the Waikato River. And he explained to me that he went down in a digger underneath the river. And I was thinking, well, how does anybody go underneath the river? There's like water, this didn't make any sense to me. But he insisted. And so I ended up doing a little bit of research, because he kept saying coffer dam. And sure enough, he was referring to a kind of aqueous engineering where they create a hole or something, they pump out the water and then they dig down under the river. It's the kind of engineering that's required when you're going to build bridges or, bury stuff in the riverbed or, in the seabed and stuff. And I found an animation on YouTube of aqueous engineering, and I showed it to him. It's this little digger, and it gets into this river, and there's a pump, and it's going down, down as the stones are being hauled out by the by the bucket load. And my dad was so excited, and he was like, "That's me. That was me. That was me." But the funniest thing was, and I was laughing my head off, I said to him, "There's no one in the digger. There's no one in the digger." And that, to me, really speaks to the climate crisis. The storytelling about the climate crisis is that it's just an environmental thing, but it invisibilizes the people who are affected by the harm, but also the people who have had to perform the harm.
One of the things I always think about when I think about the working class, even my own experiences, you have often have fewer choices, and certainly feel like you have fewer choices.
Mm-hmm.
You get a job because it's there, not necessarily because you've always wanted to be a digger driver, or you've always wanted to load docks with, you know, or unload railway wagons, because that's a job that's available. If you don't have special training, or if you don't have a university education.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you only learn about choices later on, I think.
Yeah.
Is that reasonable?
I think so, it makes me feel sad, like, or aroha, maybe. Like, love and compassion, especially for my parents, because, you know, the lack of choice does, I think, manifest as almost a sense of like a waste, like the wasted, you know, what I would have done if only type of thing. And I try really hard not to put myself through that personally, because you can't change the past. And you know, if you wallow in what you might have done instead, then you miss the opportunity in front of you. But I do feel like that's somewhat of a privilege, because I have got lots of things that I can but look what I did instead, and that's great. But in the case of my parents, and I do see a lot of people, and what I mean is, if I look into the archives and I look at the lives, the hard lives that people have led, and that overall it wasn't, it was just hard lives. You just look back and it's a series of hard, hard, hard after hard. And, you know, my mum said to me when I was driving the car the other day to go and see, of all things, Downton Abbey, why would I go and see that film, you know? Why would I? And you know why? Because I wanted, it was either that or some depressing film about sliding, kind of a sliding doors thing. And I was like, you know, mum will cry and it will be terrible and it will be hard and it will be sad. So he took her to Downton Abbey instead. And I was like, this is awful. And mum said to me on the way home when we were driving home, because she, I think, enjoyed it. She has English, you know, fuck-a-papa, and you know, and she was able to receive it on the platter that they wanted to serve that film, without having to come in over the top like I was with her. Oh my gosh! And that, you know, the things that the aristocracy and the, you know, blah blah. Anyway, when we were driving home, Mum said to me, "If I had known what I know now about my life when I was working so hard," she said, "I wouldn't have been able to do it." She said, "I wouldn't have got up. I wouldn't have chosen that. I wouldn't have chosen to work and work and work if I had known it would all come to nothing anyway." She means in terms of, you know, there's this promise that you're going to get wealth at the end of all of this work. And it's not.
It's a myth for most people.
It's a myth.
But it's a myth that works very well for capitalism.
Exactly. And you know, she's having this realization now. She's like, they don't want you to know. I'm like, no, they don't. They need the labor force.
One of the things that absolutely should be dealt with when we talk about climate change is economic inequality. Because things that happen to you, whether any kind of crisis, your economic place in the world, the choices you have, whether you own a house, for instance, or where you live. These are part of what's happening.
Mm.
It isn't just the climate change. It's never just about climate.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, even my area of interest, I think, is in the story, the narrative that we tell about climate. I do get asked questions, you know, like, well, what should we do then, and how do we transition, and, you know, kind of big structural questions. And I'm not an expert in that area. I'm interested, like everyone else, and I'm listening, and I'm scrutinizing and analyzing myself, and listening to those including scientists who have more experience in that area. What I am interested in is how we ensure that everybody can participate in how we talk about this reality that we're all facing, and the impacts of which are so uneven on different communities. And one thing that I see as a real failure is that the term climate change, because of the way it's been associated so much with extreme weather events and, the economic, which way do we go? We have in Aotearoa, we have the emissions trading scheme, which is, intended to bring down carbon emissions. And, but to me, it sort of it puts uneven focus on what are ultimately symptoms of a much more problematic setup, much more problematic way of living our lives. And so I keep thinking, like, what's a better way to show people that this is something that we are all deeply enmeshed in, especially through our labour, especially through our lack of choice. And I'm not sure that I've got. I do know. Te Reo Māori is a solution, is a real solution, because it's a language that comes from the land of this place. So our instructions about how to live in relationship with this land is held within Te Reo Māori intact, and more that language is returning to us influently with the next generation. So that's exciting. But I still think, like, what is a way to speak about this in English, which is my first language? And I think poetry is a language that is very powerful. I also kind of think that, no wonder that the idea of climate change often does repel people. The language of climate change repels people, because if you break it down, you're really talking about the atmosphere. And often people are talking about carbon emissions, which are not visible. And so when I put that in a Māori context, it would be like talking about rangi nui all the time and not talking about papatūānuku. It would be like if someone asked me to tell my life story and not reference my mother, and only reference, one part of my story, which relates to the atmosphere. And so I think the narrative is currently not given enough importance, which is crazy in a time of post-truth where, people are acting so much on emotions. It is both a danger and a threat, but it's also an opportunity to draw into our art forms, I think, and to poetry. To really bring forth what is latent within all of us, which is, well, not necessarily latent, but, within all of us we are spiritual. And, what I mean by that, when I use the word spiritual, I'm referring to Wairua and Wairua being like the internal waters, just simply that. And we all have that, and it's not bound by intellectual imperatives. We can speak to each other in different ways, and I think that's the language that is going to be more powerful to communicate about the solutions. And by solutions, I actually just mean healing the disconnect.
When we're talking about, there's a difference between scientific knowledge and knowledge based on spiritual intuition and personal experience and tradition. And don't we need both of those? But we need to interpret the science maybe in a more down-to-earth personal and spiritual way.
I think that's where the artists and the communicators come in, musicians, practitioners of healing who work with, you know, with materials, with the physical materials, resources, taonga, because of that skill that artists have, and it's a practical skill. You know, you just need to look at the power of musicians to move people en masse. It's very powerful. And I think we just have to work together with that because we need that scientific knowledge. I have so much respect and awe for the work of climate modellers who have amassed the evidence with which we have been able to make the connections and build the case that is undeniable now. So I'm very, I would never want to seem as though I'm putting that that incredible work, years and years and years of work to do that, to bring that evidence to the fore. I would never want to diminish that just because I don't get it. You know, like I look at the graphs and, basically I just have to trust, and I do trust, I mean, I don't trust everyone just because they've written a report, but you can and we should listen to that expertise, but they're not necessarily, scientists aren't necessarily the best people to carry the message. And I do think there's kind of an arrogance sometimes when certainly sometimes, you know, you will get people who are like, why aren't people paying attention? And not enough self-reflection around, well, maybe it's the way that I'm constructing the message, or maybe it's the language that's reinforcing a barrier.
It's one thing to talk about numbers and so on. Mm. I mean, even the number 1.5, you know, degrees. Mm-hmm. That's an intellectual. I mean, it's important, but it's hard to get excited about. I think everybody can see that if glaciers melt, why then the sea might rise, or that life itself has feedbacks, both on individual basis, but also on a natural, geophysical basis. Mm. When you do certain things, other things happen in connection. Everything's connected.
Yes, and it's one of the things that kind of bemuses me, I think, when people take on board things like, the 1.5 to 1.8, what can I do to impact that? Nothing. So I'm not going to do anything. And I think, that's why that, I mean, it's important, like you said, that we have these measures, so we have this evidence. But everyday people need more than that, need to believe in something more than that. And also because it's just the way that human beings are, to know how what we are doing today is going to have an impact, and where it's going to have impact and what kind of influence we can affect. And that's why, for me, I'm like, but the biggest impact that you can have is often within your own life and outlook and experience, and doing the little things that you can do is rewarding, will have often immediate feedback that enhances your life immediately, straight away. And I think for me the most compelling thing has been around, like, I think a much better invitation for people would be around the waste narrative. It's much more real to people because waste is a seen part of our lives. We people buy things and discard things packaging being a principal thing that people discard every day in masses of you know, masses of quantity, and it goes to a place called landfill. And most people don't know how to compost, which when you think about it, you know, I said to my mum 5 minutes ago, you know, this was a not, the lifestyle that we need to get to come towards is a lifestyle that I grew up with it, you know, a real thrift lifestyle. You use things until the end of their life. You repurpose things. There is no money to just keep buying and buying new stuff. And it's a kind of reverence life. It's a reverence outlook, a reverence for the origins of the things that we use, and a distaste for waste. And that is something that is extremely powerful. It's extremely effective. We can have an impact in small ways every single day by just not refusing not to buy that thing, not to buy the lettuce that comes in a packet. And the more, what I found, the little amounts that we do has positive impacts for my physical health. It is cheaper to live that way. It makes me feel better. I put out a rubbish bag every, like, I don't know, 3 to 6 weeks now. And that's not even like I'm hardcore or anything. That's just deciding within myself, I'm going to really detest waste. And the biggest thing that it costs you is time. It costs time and intention, and that is the most valuable thing that capitalism takes from us. And it does take, you know, a lot of people cannot choose the low waste, you know, lifestyle, if you like, because they don't have time. And I'm not going to say that's not real. That is real.
One of the things that, from a personal point, like, my life is better because I ride a bike more than I ever drive a car.
Right?
But
yeah,
I know that's not going to confront climate change. Actually, economic change needs to happen. Capitalism is based on growth, not just little growth, but huge amounts of growth, expanding growth all the time. Yeah. And that's what's behind what's happening to the not only climate change, but the environment. We need to find a way to live together where we don't grow. I'm not without starving or without some people's lives getting even harder than they are now. If you look at, you know, the resources to build an electric car, for instance, if you're digging the earth in Africa, in the Congo, where you pay something for that. You pay your life for that. But, so I don't think that, for instance, electric cars are the answer. I think an economy that's not based on growth and is based more on community, more on equality. I know we're not going that direction, and it's a hard ask.
I mean,
but I am also pretty sure that we can't continue for generations in the direction we're going.
Yeah, I don't think it's a hard ask, actually. I think that the story needs to be told better so that people can get on board with it. Because the word that, as you were talking, that was coming to mind was, like in relation to growth, is excess. And a counterpoint word to that would be abundance. And I do think that it comes down to language, and language can excite people and invite people in, or it can turn people off. And so, you know, I've been to a degrowth conference. I know the work that they're doing. I don't know very much about it, so I won't talk too much about it. But other than the name degrowth, often, or any name that is associated with those capitalistic ideas, ideologies, and saying, you know, like deciding to distinguish yourself by what you are not is still showing your relationship to that thing. So growth is in this, growth is still in that name. And I think we need to move away from capitalism altogether and return to this, and you said it, community, community is love, the relationality. And I would like to see us talking more about everybody having all of their needs met. And that is how nature wants to be naturally. Nature is trying to always get to a place of equilibrium. And what if we all share what we have in excess, the share what we have in abundance with others, then we will all have everything that we need. And I think that the real crisis maybe is in this space of, or it's a, you know, it's something that they've really hoodwinked people to believe that that is not possible. But it is possible. It is possible because it was the way, you know, it's only been in the last 30 years in particular, the last 40 years, at least speaking in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where, you know, suddenly we have like extreme poverty and people with extreme wealth next to people with extreme poverty and living in the same, you know, communities or very, you know, within, you know, very near localities. That is, to me, obscene. There is an obscene amount of wealth concentrated in a few, while many, many have not enough. And I think we need to seize better on describing that accurately, making it visible in the same way that working class people are not visible and their contribution and just how hard they work is not visible. We also need to make visible the obscene wealth that is concentrated in a few households. And then we don't really need to do anything except go, how do we feel about this? And everybody's going to say, well, that's unfair. And then we address the inequity.
The thing is, the story you get on television isn't about... It glorifies a superabundance. I mean, most Americans don't live like that. Most, when you hear about America, you think of California and swimming pools. Well, people don't have swimming pools. Mm. I mean, a few people do. But the way we talk about wealth and so on, we glorify wealth, I think.
I mean, I'm not sure that everyone does. This is the inadequacy of the word "we" in English is okay. That it's, you know, like it's it implies everybody does. But I know I know what you mean. That there
I don't
is
think
a,
that most people do. But what you watch on television, what you watch in the media, does.
Yes. Yeah, I do think that there is is the construction, right? Like the fiction that everybody will want this. But like we see it often in a crisis situation where when in a terrible situation, people come to each other's aid. That's probably why we love living in our neighborhoods, because we know, like, one of the things that I'm very aware of is that if something terrible did happen, I know we'd look after each other. We know each other's names. We know each other's children. We know each other. We walk each other's pets. And that's just normal life for us.
People were happy when they didn't have one. I remember when I first came to New Zealand, most family didn't have two or three cars.
Oh. And walking and riding our bikes is so good and healthy for us. I often think that the salute, if we treated the climate crisis by addressing the health, and by health I mean physical, mental, spiritual, housing, whānau, needs of people and of individuals and households, we would solve the climate crisis.
Well, we also need governments to recognize this.
Mm.
I mean, we've forgotten, governments particularly, politicians have forgotten what the common good means.
Mm.
And to me, one of the things we really have to learn, we know it in our neighborhoods, we know it in our towns in a way, we know it with each other, but when it comes to major political decisions, we've forgotten about the common good. And the common good includes the common good for nature, the common good that we all do. We can't live without breathing the air. We can't live without having clean water.
Mm.
We can't live happily if we don't respect nature.
Mm.
Maybe we can live without respecting nature, but not happily, I don't think.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, we've got about a couple of minutes, so what are your hopes?
Well, I was just thinking about how we want to live and respecting nature, and two words keep coming back to me a lot in the last couple of weeks. I'm not sure why. I don't even know exactly where I heard it from, but it was this idea of multiple liberations, and I think it's because you know, there are words that float around like, oh, you know, we'll have kai sovereignty, food sovereignty. And that, when you break that down into what that means, it just means being able to be self-sufficient in your own household and not needing to rely on supermarkets, being able to provide, you know, nutritious meals for, you know, to live and have water. And, you know, these very fundamentally basic things for our survival. But it almost, that idea of sovereignty around that, like we were talking about ownership, it implies that, like, once you're there, and Hayley Koroi is a friend of mine who writes about this, about the, you know, the idea that we're actually always in relationship with our kai and with our, you know, with the whenua. And so I suppose, when I think about multiple liberations, I think about just being able to liberate yourself from the growth mindset, from capitalism, from these constraints that are imposed upon us, just one little thing at a time, just one little thing at a time.
Thanks a lot for that. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you coming to being willing to be interviewed.
It's beautiful to be here.
Thank you
so much.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.